Good afternoon. This is the Athenaeum Review podcast. I'm Ben Lima, and we're so pleased to be here today speaking with George Shackelford, who's deputy director of the Kimball Art Museum in Fort Worth and coordinating curator for the exhibition Turner's Modern World, which is at the Kimball until February 6th, before traveling to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. George, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for asking me.
Well, I wanted to start by asking about the significance of the modern in Turner's work. In particular, there are so many different things that this exhibition shows us that makes Turner's work modern. And yet at the same time, Turner was also very interested in the ancient world, and he painted so many kind of ancient classical and biblical subjects. So I was wondering if you could maybe discuss how the modern for Turner relates to his larger sense of history and the entire kind of sweep of the past.
Well, he was an artist who treated subjects from hither, thither, and yon. I mean, from absolutely pure landscape or seascape painting to scenes, as you say, from biblical or ancient Greek and Roman history, and all the way up to scenes that are about pollution on the Thames in contemporary London. This exhibition takes a particular slice, a look at Turner through the notion of his engagement with the modern world and with the concept of modern painting. And it's drawn largely from the Turner Bequest, which consisted of the 300 oil paintings and 30,000 works on paper. I said 30,000 works on paper that were in his studio at the time of his death and which were given to the British nation after he died. And so from that immense trove of works, which is at Tate Britain, the curators selected a group of astonishing things that deal with his interest in daily life, the political and military strife of his epoch, the arrival, for instance, of the new inventions of the 19th century, and notably the steam engine, which is something that fascinated him, and then the whole notion of how to be a modern artist in a way, how to paint in a modern way. And so those themes constitute the sort of the arc of the exhibition, which begins with Turner as a very young man and ends with him in his very last exhibited works. He's an artist of enormous depth and breadth. He's born in 1775. He dies in 1851. You know, you've got the American Revolution, which is happening at the time of his, you know, infancy. And then at the other end, you have the great Crystal Palace exhibition of 1851, you know, one of the great international art fairs, art and industry fairs of the 19th century. So just a huge span of a changing time. I mean, we think we live in changing times, but, you know, imagine that the steamboat and the railway train are invented. It's basically like jet travel being invented in the lifetime of our parents and grandparents. You know, it's truly a remarkable time, and we think of it as being so kind of slow and easy. And no, it was not slow and easy at all. It was a very modern century that he lived in.
One of the things that I think many people will know about Turner is the way that, for example, his brushwork seems to anticipate impressionism and so forth. And when you're speaking about the modern, I was thinking about how in a classroom we might hear about so-called modernism happening with, you know, Picasso or something like that. And of course the impressionists are much later. So would it be fair to say that Turner is somehow ahead of his time in being so modern, or is he instead have a kind of a modernism that's a little bit different because it's in the first half of the 19th century instead of kind of the Monet era?
Well, I would say that what Turner is really known for and was remarked on in his time as well as now is his unwillingness to compromise his notion of how a painting should be made or could be made. And we see him in the 1830s really having a breakthrough moment. There's a painting in the exhibition of the burning of the Houses of Parliament, which comes to us from the Cleveland Museum of Art. And it's one of the most beautiful and best known paintings in the exhibition. And it's painted in 1835, and it's really a turning point in Turner's art, where he decides that the way the picture is painted, the way he puts the paint actually onto the canvas, the mixture of color and brushwork, which seems kind of chaotic, and yet you know that he's in total control. All of those elements come together in making a painting that is enormously powerful on an emotional level. And after that, he never turns back. He's always painting in this way that's pushing the envelope of how people conceived that a painting could be made in the middle years of the 19th century. Constable, who was younger than Turner, John Constable, the other great British landscape painter of the 19th century, Constable, you know, says that Turner painted with tinted steam, that there's kind of something that you can't really define in a Turner painting, that you feel like you can't quite reach out and touch it.
Yeah.
And that kind of all over way of painting, the way that a Turner canvas seems to be filled with marks all over the painting. You know, there's sort of not an inactive part in any of his paintings. And I think that's something that when they discovered it, artists like Monet and Whistler were enormously impressed by.
Mm-hmm.
Other artists felt challenged by it and found it rather despicable as a way of painting. But there were a few artists who really got it. And that impulse lasted well into the 20th century when, you know, abstract expressionist artists like Rothko discover Turner for themselves, you know, anew in shows at MoMA, for instance.
Speaking of Rothko and so forth, and I know there's this idea of the abstract sublime and the artists you mentioned kind of in this arc throughout these decades. Do you think that this idea of the sublime kind of implies a sense of kind of nature being so indifferent to humanity? I know that Turner is sometimes described as having a sense of kind of pessimism or a sense that the ultimate reality of the wind and steam and sun kind of is looming over humanity, but not really, you know, it doesn't care about humanity, which would be very different from the kind of religious viewpoint that was so common. So do you think this idea of the sublime expresses some aspect of that?
Well, I think the notion of the sublime, which is this sort of aesthetic theoretical concept that gets sort of defined in the 18th century, in the generations before Turner, that sense that there is part of nature that inspires awe to such a huge degree that it is so moving that we call it the sublime. It gives us this sense of I don't want to say nothingness in a way of powerlessness in the face of something so big and so sort of incomprehensibly powerful that we are awed by it. And so that notion of the sublime plays through Turner from his very beginnings in works in which, for instance, you might feel a forge at night.
Yeah,
you know, there's something kind of magical about it and mysterious about it. And that happens. And then, you know, at the very end of his career in the 1840s, we find him showing nature as so powerful that man is absolutely hopeless against it. There's a great painting in the exhibition of a steamship in a snowstorm. And the snowstorm is just so much more powerful than the steamship that you know that it's not good for the steamship to be out in the snow like that. And so that's a theme that runs through his art. And it does, I think, as he goes on, that search for sublime effects does have a parallel in his changing, style, and in his evolving towards this more energetic, more powerful in a way of painting. And we see it in paintings like the whaling pictures. We've got four different paintings of whalers out in the Arctic or even maybe the polar regions of the South Seas. And they're trapped in ice or in a storm, or the whale is leaping out from the sea, and you know they're filled with these powerful effects. In the last couple of paintings in the exhibition, there's a lurid sunset behind the ancient Napoleon, or a nocturne in which a friend of Turner's is being buried at sea. I mean, there are these dramatic moments that are really heightened by the way that the artist actually paints it. You know, by the colors he chooses, by that energetic and kind of trembling brushwork that he encompasses again and again.
Speaking about kind of in particular the human side of it, well, in particular the Industrial Revolution, and mentioning the era of steam and steamships and so forth, you know, I was interested in kind of Turner's attitude, because there is a way of looking at this that sees these things as kind of infernal, demonic, satanic, a kind of nightmare in a way, and that doesn't really quite seem like his attitude. But then also in contrast, Turner being so closely associated with John Ruskin, but also Ruskin's attitude towards the modern world vis-a-vis the medieval world, let's say, is also a little bit different from Turner. So I wondered if you might contrast, let's say, Turner's sense of the modern steam-driven world with those alternatives or other ways of thinking.
Well, I would say that Ruskin identifies a lot with Turner.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that Turner identifies a lot with Ruskin.
Yeah.
So Ruskin, defines himself through his appreciation of Turner, and he sees in Turner what he wants to see.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that when Turner is painting a stretch of the Thames that in London, in this painting that we have in the show, of the Thames above Waterloo Bridge. And it is a conflagration of pollutants. I mean, it is a steamboat pulled up to the shore on the left, belching out steam and smoke from its chimneys. It's the chimneys of factories on the south bank of the Thames belching out more noxious fumes and every sort of horror that you could possibly imagine. And I think Turner loved it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think for Turner it was a chance to paint all that that atmosphere, what Monet would later call the envelope, the atmosphere that rested between his eye and the nominal motif. He wanted to be able to paint the air between these two things, and that's what Turner is doing. He's painting the air as it is revealed through things that are floating in it, and that that is so much an anti medieval idea. I mean, he really is not. I don't think he is the least bit worried about climate change.
Yeah.
Turner just not. I mean, we see it. We see this painting, and we think, oh my God, he is noting that the machine is changing the world, and we know now what the effects, both good and evil, are of the machine changing the world. But Turner, I think, is for it. I mean, he's absolutely all for it. And so you see him, he uses steam power as a kind of stand-in for what man is capable of.
Yeah.
You know, so a steamboat that is heading into a storm is modern man heading into the limitless power of nature. And And the fact that the steam engine is really something that, you know, with people like Fulton, I mean, the steam engine is invented in the 18th century. It gets applied to travel in the 19th century with the steamboat and the railroad train, and these two things change Britain enormously. I mean, the for instance, Turner in the beginning of his career is painting the canals that transverse the British countryside so that boats can go across Britain with goods on them being towed by oxen or donkeys or mules or whatever, and steam engines change all that, and the canal system almost becomes irrelevant when the train system comes in. So he's very aware of the what is happening in his country.
Yeah.
And I think he's fascinated by it. And you know, there might be a little bit of him saying, you know, be mindful of the way that we are living.
Yeah.
But not, I think, in a preachy way like Ruskin would be.
Interesting.
You know?
Yeah. I was thinking, I mean, not only about Ruskin, but more broadly in terms of his general reception or kind of the response to his work at the time. I mean, clearly he was extremely successful and obviously brilliant. But it was very interesting to learn that many, you know, there were mixed responses in various ways. I learned, for instance, that both Thackeray and Mark Twain didn't really approve, or many people didn't really approve of the slave ship painting.
Yeah.
And apparently William Hazlitt thought that this kind of brushwork was too much like primordial chaos and so forth. I mean, in spite of the fact that he was successful, is it true that, I mean, did anyone really truly kind of understand the full breadth of his work at the time, or was it just that he was so rich that it takes a few decades or centuries to really understand the whole?
Well, you know, you mentioned Mark Twain, and
yeah.
his quote is too good not to requote.
Okay.
When Mark Twain sees the slave ship by Turner, a painting, alas, not in this exhibition, but you'll be able to read and see more about it in the context of our programming in the Dallas Morning News, and this painting gets exhibited in Boston in the 1870s, and Twain, who's just a great wag, says, someone compared it to a tortoiseshell cat having a fit in a platter of tomatoes.
Oh, that's amazing.
And in fact, when you look at the painting, you say, I see what he means. You know,
yeah,
it is. I mean, it is something is going on in the middle of it. And it's a kind of an explosion. Now, the platter of tomatoes is important for that picture because of how red the painting is, and the tortoiseshell cat with its spots is, you know, and the idea of a cat having a fit, and you know, you get something of the sense of the whirligig that is a good analogy for the way that painting works compositionally. But then you have a painting like the one in the exhibition here in Fort Worth of the steamship in the snowstorm. And it's a painting which, when first seen, you know, somebody says, you know, Turner has used every element in the kitchen. He's painting with gravy and mashed potatoes. I mean, I paraphrase, but,
yeah.
But basically it's the notion is that people found it incomprehensible and not what they were expecting, you know, a painting should be. I go back to John Constable, however, who says that the public looks at Turner, they don't understand it right away, and they think that Turner is having them on, is making fun of them. And so their reaction is to laugh.
Yeah.
When in fact Turner is not having them on at all.
Yeah.
I mean, he's completely sincere in what he's doing. He believes, I mean, very intently on what the way his paintings look like. He means for them to look like that, and he means for them to move you. And if they don't, then has he failed? Have we failed? I'm not really quite sure. But Constable goes on to say that because the public thinks that Turner is fooling them or making fun of them, they laugh at him. And so they use that laughter, that ridicule, or the, you know, for Mark Twain or Thackeray or you know, just the critic from the London newspapers in 1840. They're nervous about it, and so they laugh at it. And I think we see this happening in our own day a lot with art that challenges us and that really we don't quite understand what it is that's going on. And I think we have to give the artist, first of all, we have to give the artist the benefit of the doubt that it is completely serious. Now, it's not always a success, but we have to take the artist seriously and try to get it and not laugh when we don't, not make fun of the artist when we don't get it. And I think that's a lesson actually that is eternal, that we can take a lesson from Turner and the reception that his works got when they were first made, because now we revere them. Yeah. We think almost everybody that I know thinks Turner is a god.
Yeah, yeah.
Every painter that I know thinks Turner is a god.
Yeah.
And so we've got this appreciation of him now. And then we look back at what his contemporaries felt. And these were people who were going to art shows. We're not talking about the, you know, general public who sees it as a joke through some cartoon. It's people who have been motivated to go to the Royal Academy exhibition, and they don't get it, and they're making fun of it. And now we think, oh, those poor benighted souls. But in fact, it was normal. I mean, it was a challenge for them, and so I think it's a good object lesson for us now.
Yes,
you know? I mean, Turner is in a way that kind of modern that we can still be learning from him here, you know, 150 years after his death. You know, more than that.
One of the things that of course really struck me looking at the exhibition had to do with how and of course thinking about the context. How he's so, in so many ways, obviously identified with Britain and British history. I was thinking this is really kind of my image of British history of the period is looking at what's happening in these, and then of course his bequest to the Tate, and I mean his name's on the Turner Prize, and all these subjects like Trafalgar and Waterloo, and I say, okay, this is what, you know, this is what British art is defined by, but yet also thinking that he's clearly so. Highly conscious of everything to do with continental Europe and European painting, and he loves Italy, and he's so astute about the whole tradition of European painting, Rembrandt or Claude Lorrain or so forth. So I was thinking, is he somehow is his sort of interpretation of Europe and European painting is that a kind of British interpretation that he gives, or does he kind of help define European painting for a British audience, or I guess how those two kind of sides of him fit together?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, he begins his career, you know, very much within the confines of Britain, and the earliest works that we see him making are all about the British countryside, or you know, things that are happening in small town England.
Yeah.
And then he goes to the continent. He goes across the English Channel, and he makes his first visits to the continent, and he goes to France, and he goes to Germany, and he goes to Switzerland, and he sees the Alps. And you know, the exhibition here opens with a great big painting of the falls at Schaffhausen, and and it's the great waterfall on the Rhine near Basel, and it's a subject. He painted it back in his studio in London, but he had seen it and he had been aware of the kind of it's sublime effects that you saw in Switzerland that you didn't see in Britain. There aren't any Alps in Britain.
You don't
get that kind of awe in the British landscape. So he gets to see that, and he gets across the Alps, and he sees what Italy is like. And, you know, Italy is the destination for every grand tourist. So every milord who went to, in the 18th century, who went off to spend a year in Europe on the grand tour, you know, accompanied by his teacher and his art teacher and such, Turner kind of makes that pilgrimage as the son of a barber. And he gets himself off to Italy, and he sees the Renaissance, and he sees Venice, and he sees what Venetian painting is like. And it makes him maybe the most cosmopolitan of British painters of his era, who had really seen what there was and understood the historical import of the continent vis-a-vis, you know, the United Kingdom vis-a-vis Britain, and he plays with that a lot. You know, he keeps painting. He paints Vesuvius before he has ever gone to Naples.
Okay.
I mean, you know,
okay.
from you know, Prince and stuff, he paints an erupting Vesuvius before he has ever had a chance to be there, and he never witnessed Vesuvius erupting. So, you know, so he's capable of doing those kinds of subjects out of his head. And you know, almost all of the Venetian oil paintings are painted in Britain, not in Venice, but there are dozens and dozens and hundreds of fantastic watercolors and little notebooks. He's constantly got one or two, maybe three or four notebooks in his pockets that he can make little tiny sketches in. There are a couple of notebooks in the exhibition that, as we were putting the show together, we were able to page through the notebooks very carefully and to see what else beside the opening that we were going to show you, what else was there in the notebook? And there's one that has to do with Waterloo. Yeah. And so he's going over to Waterloo 2 years after the battle. But on his way to the battlefield, he's making drawings in Bruges and Brussels, and, you know, and he's really being a tourist. And there's always in him that idea of I see something, I've got to note it down, I've got to remark on it, because it's going to be useful for me later one way or another. So I do think that he has, you know, to get back to your question, he does have this really broad appreciation, not only for what's happening in Europe in his day, but also for the great history of European art. And mind you, by the latter part of his career, there is the National Gallery in London. There is also the Dulwich Picture Gallery down in Dulwich, you know, 20 miles from the center of London, maybe not even that. And also at Petworth, at the home of his great friends, he's able to see historical art by artists like Claude Lorrain, the great French painter active in Rome, by Poussin. He can see paintings by Titian and Tintoretto from the Venetians. He can see paintings by Rembrandt, as you say, and so he's got the history of art is available to him in London and in Britain as well, and so when he goes about writing his will, he insists that certain of his pictures, though he's leaving the entire thing to the state to do what they want to with it, they have to build a building for it. And he says that he wants some of his paintings to be hanging by paintings by Claude Lorrain, so that he will forever be in juxtaposition with this artist that he considers one of the great masters of historical landscape. And so he wants to be part of that. And he sort of assures that he's going to be part of that grand tradition by the terms of his will.
Something else that of the many, many things that really struck me as I was looking at the exhibition, in this case, as an American in 2021, almost 2022, you know, clearly one of the things that that's apparent and is discussed is the way that these wars, the Revolutionary Wars, Napoleonic Wars, stretched over so many years. And I thought, oh yes, you know, as you know, our country now has also been engaged in these military campaigns for now many, many years. And then furthermore, the significance of the Royal Navy and this kind of globe-spanning military force, you know, sailing all of the oceans. And I said, oh yes, that's right. You know, now America, the United States has a navy that is around the globe and is sailing past China and Japan and India and so forth. So I guess I would ask these themes or these subjects about kind of the world, Britain and the world in this time. Are there certain things that you think might strike an American right now as ringing, seeming very familiar, or something that we might recognize as being somehow in a parallel situation or something?
I think there are themes that Turner is interested in, which are enormously powerful for us now. I mentioned already the painting of pollution. I mean, it's a subject that Turner touches on, and that we now understand in a different way than he did, but it is there very much. It's there in his painting. The power of the engine, the power of man's ability to transform nature is there in his art. I think that another topic that he is very aware of, he doesn't hit you over the head with it, but it's nonetheless there, is the difference between the rich and the poor in Britain of his time. And, you know, when he paints the Prince Regent's birthday party on Richmond Hill and calls the painting England. He's touting a vision of what people think England should be, the green and pleasant land that Blake refers to. But at the same time, London is one of the most putrid cities in Europe, in the world. And when he paints peasants plowing up turnips within sight of Windsor Castle, and we know from the backstory that the painting is about the fact that George III, who lives in Windsor Castle, has allowed the nobles of Britain to fence their land off so that the peasants can't actively farm on what had been considered common land previously. That Turner is painting a painting with a subtle political message, which is about income inequality. And so that's a theme that is there in Turner's art. Parallel to that, closely aligned with that, is the fact that he was very, very interested in the extension of the vote to as many people as possible. Before the 1830s, you had to be a landowner to have a vote in Britain. And the reform laws of the early 1830s, the political reform movement of that period, which Turner was very much in favor of and living through, extended that vote. Now, it still didn't extend to women. That didn't happen until even after the women got the vote in the United States. But you did have a much larger segment of the British population being given the right to determine their political future, their governmental future, be able to vote for Parliament. And it changes the way Britain is in the 1830s and 1840s, and it gives so much more power to the middle and lower middle classes than they had ever had before. So the issue of who gets to decide is one that is very powerful to us right now, and it was powerful in Turner's time. And then I think the potential issue of human cruelty,
yes,
is present in Turner's work. The slave ship, which is not here, is extremely explicit about this. But there's another painting that is in this exhibition that's based on the wreck of a British ship, the Amphitrite, which wrecked off the shore of France. The captain refused aid from the shore because his passengers, who were really his cargo, were convicted women who were being sent to prison in Australia.
Yeah.
And if they had gotten onto the French shore, they would have been free. And so he denied the help, the ship went down, and all but three people died. Yeah. That's an image of wanton cruelty, which Turner clearly decried. Interestingly, the painting was so dramatic that he never finished it and never exhibited it. And you see it here. It's a monumental picture, and it clearly would have been a very big statement. And it's enormously powerful, and maybe too much for people to bear, because so true. Yeah. And the women and children are just dying in front of your eyes in the painting. And so I think the issue of caring for the powerless, caring for the poor and the powerless is a theme that is very powerful in Turner, and one which again rings very true to us in our day, as to who cares about the most downtrodden in our societies. And that's true universally. I mean, across the world, it's not just an American phenomenon. But I think it's something that is in Turner's art that is universal and timeless, and therefore always modern.
Yeah, it seems like a few of the things that you've just mentioned. There might be so many ways that Turner might line up kind of on the more progressive side of things, or you mentioned the reform of the vote and so forth. But it also seems, is it true that he was appreciated kind of across the spectrum, or were there people who were on the more traditionalist side who rejected him because they thought he's too progressive, or was he able to kind of get across that divide?
Well, it's really interesting. A lot of his clientele were newly made fortunes.
Right, right.
He had a lot of people bought his paintings because they were the hottest thing going, and sometimes there was one of his clients who he painted some whaling pictures for, and the guy sent them back because they weren't detailed enough. They didn't show whaling like he thought whaling should be shown, and because you couldn't see enough action, you couldn't define enough action in the paintings. And that, I think, was not an uncommon reaction in a way. One of his pictures got bought in America very early, and the guy was really disappointed because that it didn't have enough detail. And so I think that the reaction to Turner was it depended a lot on kind of who you were. And I think if you were an art enthusiast, you might really love them. Yeah. If you were one of his clients, who might be like the Earl of Egremont, loved his Turners, but he loved Turner personally.
Yeah.
they were great friends. So I think that and Ruskin adored Turner, in every way, and so I think you could have a a clientele who bought Turner maybe because it was the chic thing to do. You know, I need to have a painting by so-and-so, or I've got to have a sculpture by Jeff Koons to be, you know, cool nowadays.
Yeah.
And there were some people who bought Turner for that reason. And I don't think that people necessarily bought Turner for political reasons. I don't think it was, I think that the subject matter of his paintings, for the most part, was not, or the political stance of his paintings, for the most part, was not the reason why they were purchased. I mean, the really notable exception to that is when Alice Hooper in Boston buys The Slave Ship. She buys it because she knows nothing about the painting as a painting. Yeah. She buys it because of the theme. And she is from a family of abolitionists, and so she is specifically buying the painting on account of its thematic subject. There's a pair of paintings that I really would love to have had for the exhibition that are in the National Gallery in Washington, and the 2020-2021 COVID mess made it impossible for them to consider lending. But they're interesting because the first picture that the man bought was a scene in Venice. And beautiful, beautiful sunlit canal. Gorgeous, wonderful. Perfect. He goes back to Turner and says, I want a British scene to go with it. And so the daylight Venetian scene is matched by Turner with a nocturne of coal barges being loaded in Newcastle.
Wow.
You know, so sunny Venice, the old world matched by nocturne, you know, dark satanic mills, to use Blake again, notion of industrial Britain. And so you can have a commission that is loaded with meaning, you know, loaded with political meaning, and specifically in that case, kind of asked for.
Yeah,
you kind of wonder: did he really know what he was getting, the client? Yeah. You know, was he did he realize that the second picture was going to have so much commentary on the first one? Yeah. When he ordered them, but yes, you could have a client who specifically wanted to have a Turner, or a pair of Turners in that case, that had a kind of meaning for modern life, and a moral lesson in a way.
Yeah. I know that you've worked with Turner for many years. I mean, previously you were at the MFA in Boston before coming here to the Kimball, and obviously know the artist intimately. And I was just curious for this current exhibition, for Turner's Modern World, and maybe for people who think they know Turner, if there's anything that might be surprising to people who think that they're familiar with Turner, or anything that struck you as maybe something new that not everyone would have recognized about the artist before seeing this show.
Well, I tell you what great exhibitions like this are always about is the encounter with the real thing. And so if you've seen Turner in a book, or if you haven't seen Turner since you saw the great exhibition in Dallas in 2008,
yes, yeah,
it's time to come back.
Yes, yeah.
And it's time to come and look at what the paintings really are like when you can see them with your own two eyes. Because, you know, we've got binocular vision, and we see depth, and we perceive depth. And even in a flat painting, there is depth to be perceived. There's color to be perceived. There is the intensity of color and the action of the painter's hand, which you can witness with your naked eye. I mean, you see it happening. And Turner, more than many, many other artists, gives you the evidence of the making of the thing is there on the surface of it. And I think that's what happens in the burning of the Houses of Parliament, for instance. He never more will he disguise the fact that he painted it, and that the painting of it is really important to the way that it looks, and to what it means. And so, you have to come see it. You can't make do with seeing it on our wonderful website. Or seeing it on you know, Google or Bing or, you know, TenEye. You've got to come and physically encounter the real things. Now, once you've done that, if you want to go back and blow the thing up on Google to, you know, maximum volume and see in greater detail than in fact your binocular vision can give you, you know, we've got we have the capacity to send you off to places where you can see that kind of depth. But you must come and witness these things in the flesh, as it were, because it just changes the way you perceive everything.
It really does. It's such an amazing, magnificent exhibition. Well, we've been speaking with George Shackelford today about the exhibition Turner's Modern World, which is at the Kimball Museum until February 6th before going to the MFA in Boston. Thank you very much for having this conversation.
It's such a pleasure to be with you, Ben. Thanks.
And this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and you can find out more at athenaeumreview.org.